Sandy, this deal is not perception, it's reality. But it changes the perception of the Mets as a big-time player in Major League Baseball.
Sometimes perception is reality, sometimes it's not. What we're trying to do is change the reality and let the perception follow.
That was Sandy Alderson, president of the New York Mets, on the first blockbuster of the MLB offseason. His acquisition of 27-year-old Francisco Lindor from the Cleveland Indians. Today, Buster Olney dissects the Mets' new superstar, their new reality, and what this all signals about the sport. Then, we talk to Elizabeth Williams of the WNBA's Atlanta Dream about campaigning against the team's owner in the Georgia Senate election and watching the highs and lows of American democracy from far, far away. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, January 8th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Buster, we've been waiting for a big splash, a big domino to tip over in the MLB offseason, and we got one yesterday. The New York Mets acquired Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco from the Cleveland Indians for two shortstops and two minor leaguers, an enormous transaction. How surprised are you that this happened?
Not surprised at all.
Buster Olney is the host of the Baseball Tonight podcast, and he has been covering baseball for more than three decades.
Look, in the last few years, there had been so much industry speculation about when would the Indians trade Lindor. In fact, a couple of years ago, Paul Dolan, their owner, told the fan base, look, enjoy him while you can, because it was an assumption he was going to be traded. I think if not for the pandemic, he would have been traded in the middle of last summer. So the Indians moving now, and the fact that the Mets were the buyers, that's not surprising either, because I think Mets fans have been waiting for Steve Cohn's team to make a big move, and he certainly did that in getting the best shortstop in baseball.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the Cleveland side of the equation in a little bit, but I first want to dive into the buyer that you mentioned, because Steve Cohn, Buster, the Mets' new owner, a hedge fund billionaire, self-identifying, proudly so, diehard Mets fan from Long Island. He's been on Twitter all offseason, making very loud noises about this being a new, different kind of organization.
You know, we want to be excellent in all areas of this game. That's going to require resources, and I'm fully committed to making that happen.
He is so monumentally wealthy. I mean, he was one of the few people who didn't lose money in this pandemic-shortened 2020 MLB season. So what does this trade tell you about the promise of his regime?
Yeah, he's the richest owner in baseball now, and I wrote in a piece for ESPN.com that for Mets fans who have suffered through with their PTSD of the Wilpons,
yes,
this is the finally they get their reward, where they have an owner who's willing to go toe-to-toe with the Yankees.
I'm going to be an owner who builds a team that has continued success. I don't just want to get into the playoffs. I want to win a championship.
You know, through the years since I've been working in the New York market, the assumption whenever a really big name came up was that the Yankees probably would elbow the Mets out of the way, and they would get the players, and the Mets would operate like an upper middle class team rather than a big market team. And this deal signals a change in that.
But what I do believe is this is a major market team, and it should have a budget commensurate with that.
The Yankees could have used the shortstop. There were other big market teams that could have used the shortstop, and the Mets get the best shortstop.
So, Buster, because you are a veteran of the New York market, I need to know, how is Lindor going to help reshape just the identity of the team itself? Because, I mean, look, you know Lindor. You reported a feature about him. We'll get to that in a bit as well. But just how good is he? What's his potential here?
Well, he's the perfect player for the Mets right now. He's an elite defensive shortstop.
Smash towards the hole. Backhanded by Lindor. Off-balance throw. On the money! He got it!
You know, in recent years, Jacob deGrom has been great, despite the fact the Mets have been really poor on defense. It's shortstop, especially. They need more lineup balance. Lindor's a switch hitter. They could use some more power.
That's drilled. Lindor with a long home run way out of here.
Lindor hits for power. They could use speed. Lindor does that.
He looked like the roadrunner as he took off from first base.
And he absolutely has the personality to be the face of a franchise in New York. You know, you're talking about someone who loves to play. His nickname is Mr. Smile. I think Mets fans absolutely will gravitate toward him.
Yeah, Mr. Smile is exactly what New York Mets fans have not resembled for decades now, Buster. But this isn't yet like all locked and loaded because there is a contract issue here. What's the latest with Lindor's deal and what do the Mets have to do on that front?
Yeah, he is eligible for free agency theoretically next fall, but it's been interesting. You know, as baseball's seen a change in its financial landscape, agents have been telling me that the best player leverage is not when you hit free agency anymore. It's the year before you become a free agent. We saw that with Mookie Betts last winter. He gets traded to the Dodgers, last summer agreed to this monstrous deal, the second biggest deal in baseball history. And if you're Francisco Lindor now, you know, you've already turned down a $100 million offer from the Indians early in your career, and now you go to the Mets, and there's no question they will try to sign him. And keep in mind, next fall, it's going to be an historic class of elite shortstop, Carlos Correa, Corey Seager, Trevor Story, Javier Baez. So if you're Lindor right in this moment, you're the one Lamborghini on the lot, right? and you might want to make your best deal now. And that's why people around the game expect that the Mets and Lindor will work out a long-term deal.
Okay, so we have Lamborghinis, we got hedge fund billionaires. But Buster, where does this leave the Cleveland Indians as a franchise? Because they are, look, the logo, the naming stuff, that's its own issue. But there's also like deeper financial questions here about their viability.
That's exactly right. You're talking about a franchise that, you know, in 2018 had $135 million payroll. Their payroll may be under $50 million in 2021. Now, Indians fans, Cleveland fans have grown accustomed to them trading their best players. CC Sabathia, Cliff Lee, Trevor Bauer, Mike Clevenger, now Lindor. But to see the Indians take their payroll down to the level of the Tampa Bay Rays, that's going to make people wonder, you know, is baseball something that can be sustained in Cleveland? And by the way, their front office is considered, generally speaking, in the industry to be the best in baseball. And even, you know, despite some of their financial struggles the last decade, they have consistently contended. Without Lindor, that's going to be a lot harder.
So what's the optimistic angle for fans there? Is there a process here, an Astros-style process, in quotes, dare I say? Are there returns here that they're getting for unloading their star players?
No, I think that more likely the model is going to be what we've seen with the Tampa Bay Rays, where a team which is really good at developing pitching in the way the Indians are, you know, build a rotation around Shane Bieber in the next couple of years. But you see with the Rays that despite their success, they have to constantly turn over the team. And I think that what lies in the future of the Indians. I don't think they're going to be a team that's going to be able to retain big, expensive stars ever. That's why they traded Lindor.
So, Buster, I want to zoom out for a second here, too, looking at the broader health of the league with the haves now and the have-nots. What does all of this indicate to you on that front?
How much the financial landscape in baseball is changing after the sport suffered the effect of the pandemic last year. Look, when you talk to agents and you ask them, okay, which teams are being aggressive right now? You hear the Toronto Blue Jays. We heard the San Diego Padres, who made those two aggressive trades for Blake Snell and Yu Darvish. And you hear the Mets. And besides that, there are not a lot of teams out there spending money. The Yankees are not doing much. To this point, the Dodgers haven't done much. The Red Sox haven't done much. When the Darvish deal went down, a lot of the reaction in the industry was, wow, the Cubs didn't get much for Darvish in what was essentially a salary dump. I heard the same things from agents and some players after the Lindor deal was announced. It tells you that there's just not a lot of financial flexibility in terms of how owners are running their teams.
All right, Buster, after the break, I want to dive back into Francisco Lindor, who you profiled, spent a lot of time with, and get to understand him better.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Buster, you profiled Francisco Lindor last year for E60 in a feature piece that was wonderful. And I know Lindor grew up in Puerto Rico. I'm less clear about what kind of a guy he is. What's his upbringing like?
Well, he was essentially raised by his mom and his oldest sister, Legna. His mom is working during the day. Legna is about 7 years older than he is, and he looked up to her like a second mom. And he is a terrific person, and he is a driven person, and he's an incredibly happy person. The Indians players would tell me about when he would come through the clubhouse door, he would light up a room. I think that he's going to be someone that now that he's going to be in a position of leadership with the Mets, he'll respond to that because he's not afraid of taking on responsibility on being accountable within a clubhouse.
Your E60 profile, that really did dwell a lot on his remarkable relationship with his older sister, Legna, who you mentioned. Tell us about that for those who are unfamiliar.
Doing these interviews with Francisco and Legna, it was so warming for me. It was like you walk away from those interviews saying, man, what a great relationship between these two siblings.
Whatever Legna says, that goes.
Why do you look at her that way?
She's always looked out after us.
I felt that I have kind of like a son. And since then, I treat him like a son, more than like a brother.
During the 2016 season, as the Indians were making a push that would eventually lead into the World Series, Legna had a diagnosis of stage 2 cervical cancer. She told her doctors, look, before I tell anybody else, before I talk to anybody else, I got to fly up to Cleveland and I got to talk to Francisco because she knew how affected he would be. And so that year, as he is making the All-Star team for the first time, as he's having success, he's also worried about his sister.
Ask why is it happening? Why to me? Why to her?
Remarkably, you know, the Indians wind up playing to Game 7 of the World Series that year, and on his drive to the ballpark for Game 7 against the Cubs, he gets the phone call from his sister.
She called me and said, hey, whatever happens tonight, we did it.
What do you mean?
It's like a big cancer. And then she sent me a video of her ringing the bell.
My treatment's done. This course is run, and I am on my way.
Yeah. I walked in that clubhouse. I'm good. I got my sister.
Francisco walks through the clubhouse door, and his feeling was, look, no matter what else happens today, we won. I won. My family won because Legna's going to be okay.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
And it wasn't just any Game 7 of a World Series, Buster. It was in particular, like, one of the most epic Game 7s that the Cubs ended up winning that we've ever seen.
Yeah, look, the Indians have not won the World Series since, the 1940s. The Cubs, of course, hadn't won the World Series since 1908. And it really stuck out to me after the Cubs survived that crazy Game 7 with the big Indians comeback.
The 2-2 and a swing and a ball hit hard down the left field line. It's a tie game. A home run for Rajay Davis.
The rain falling. The delay, Jason Hayward's speech to the Cubs. The Cubs, you know, wind up scoring a run and winning the World Series. It jumped out at me being in the Indians clubhouse after the game when I looked at Lindor's face. He did seem happy. And I was wondering what that was about. And a couple weeks later, I was talking with an Indians official and asked about that. And it was like, boy, he seemed like he was okay. And he said, well, here's the reason why. You know, he got good news about Legna.
So Now Francisco is joining the Mets, and if he signs an extension there, as you alluded to before, the expectations are going to be, like, official that, hey, World Series, that is the next stop on this road. And Steve Cohen famously said in his opening press conference that he wants to win a World Series within 3 to 5 years, Buster, which is a remarkable proclamation to make ever, really, but specifically in New York with the Mets. So what else needs to happen for that to become more realistic?
Right now, this team is a World Series contender. You think about what they've added. They've improved their bullpen by adding Trevor May. They address their catching situation with James McCann. They get Lindor, the best shortstop in baseball. You've got Jacob DeGrom, who's the best pitcher on the planet. In the context of the National League East, they still have to climb the mountain of the Atlanta Braves, which has won this division repeatedly in recent years. If you cut the Washington Nationals, who were the 2019 champions, I still think the Mets have moves to make this winter.
What are the names that are sort of lingering?
George Springer, the free agent outfielder who went to UConn. He's from the Northeast. He can play center field, and he's a right-handed power hitter. Makes him absolutely perfect for the Mets. And I'm sure that that's what Mets fans at this point, they're waiting to see. Will Steve Cohen's money manifest in getting George Springer?
Buster Olney, thank you for bringing an enormous smile to the faces of Mets fans everywhere.
Thanks, Pablo.
Coming up, there is one athlete who I wanted to talk to about this week in American democracy, and she is more than 6,000 miles away.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Elizabeth Williams is a forward for the WNBA's Atlanta Dream. She's had a long week. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me today. Where are we reaching you right now?
I am actually in Ankara, Turkey. I'm 8 hours ahead of the East Coast.
Williams is playing overseas in Turkey during the WNBA offseason, and we first reached out over Zoom on Wednesday for her reaction to the Georgia Senate runoff. Reverend Raphael Warnock had just been announced as the winner over Senator Kelly Loeffler.
And this is breaking news. NBC News now projects Raphael Warnock as the winner in the special Georgia Senate election.
Now, Loeffler, to recap, has co-owned the Atlanta Dream since 2010, and this past summer, the senator began speaking out against her own players, including Elizabeth, condemning their support of Black Lives Matter.
Loeffler has sent a letter to Commissioner Kathy Engelbert objecting to the league's initiatives to honor the Black Lives Matter movement when the season begins.
Players from the Dream and around the entire WNBA responded, debuting game day shirts that said "Vote Warnock" to support Loeffler's opponent. And the relationship only grew more contentious and politically consequential from there. So I wanted to ask Elizabeth Williams for her thoughts on the Warnock win.
I think first, like, really relieved because this has been such a long journey, long before even the general election and, you know, first talking to Reverend Warnock in the summer up until this moment. Probably started in going to my first protest in Atlanta. I was encouraged by someone to put myself out there and go to a protest and feel the emotions behind all of this. And then obviously when our owner made her statements, I felt like I was kind of in the forefront of the messaging and communicating with players. And so it just continued to grow. And now we're here. So it's wild.
I mean, the WNBA, Elizabeth, really did choose him, Reverend Warnock, as the candidate to back in this election. Why?
So for us, we wanted to make sure that as we continued our work in social justice and we continued to promote voting and registering to vote, we also stayed true to ourselves as WNBA players. And so we wanted to support a candidate who supported a lot of things that we did, could progress this country. And ironically enough, you know, his seat and Ossoff's seat ended up being the seats to flip the entire Senate. So it's been really powerful to see.
When you're on the internet and you see the degree of credit that people are giving you guys, saying that you were the sort of tipping point here, that you were one of the first real backers of Warnock, that it was in fact those shirts, the WNBA shirts, where people first saw that name nationally. What's your reaction to all of that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I think for us, we were going to do the work regardless. But it's also, it's cool to see the impact that it had and that people are starting to recognize that and recognize Black women for this work. And, you know, it wasn't just us, but, you know, the people on the ground, these organizations, New Georgia Project, like all these groups for us, the massive voter turnout, which, you know, Stacey Abrams played a huge part in. We wanted to use our platform to not only get Warnock's name out there, but to make sure people understood that there are organizations that have been doing this work for a really long time. And now hopefully people will watch the WNBA and support us on the court as much as they've supported us off the court.
A lot is happening, Elizabeth, on this front. LeBron James tweeted that he is interested in putting together an ownership group for your Atlanta Dream. What goes through your mind when you see LeBron say that in public?
I was pretty shocked. I know, you know, with his work with More Than a Vote and all the organizations that he's worked with in getting people registered to vote and understanding their rights as it relates to voting has been really impactful. So I was really surprised when I saw that tweet. And now there are more tweets. I saw Mookie Betts quoted it and was like, oh yeah, I'm in, and Kerry Washington and all these people. So I'm like, all right, I mean, if you're in, like, I'm here, I'm waiting. So we'll see.
Has Kelly Loeffler been in contact with you or other players on the Dream at all throughout this entire time period?
No, we haven't talked to her directly. I know other players. I know Renee had like an open letter to her and no response. So I think that was another reason we just wanted to focus our energy on someone else. Part of the hesitancy was kind of waiting on this election. So I think pretty soon we're going to see some type of statement or change or like movement as it relates to her ownership. So I think we're kind of in a wait and see moment, but anticipating some type of movement.
And then we signed off and let Elizabeth continue her evening in Turkey, 6,000 miles away from her home country, only to watch chaos unfold here with the attack on the U.S. Capitol and now its aftermath. So yesterday, we called Elizabeth back. So Elizabeth, now we're talking again because it's just a few hours after Congress has certified the electoral votes for Joe Biden as president, following a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, which basically stopped the country and the world. So we just wanted to follow up here. What are you thinking right now as all of this unfolds?
Ooh, it's been a lot. I think kind of my first reaction was shame. I think when we've kind of touched on this, but that juxtaposition of something incredible happening, you know, a historic first with, you know, Georgia having its first Black senator, and then you have the riots. Like, it's kind of been this constant theme that we've seen, you know, over this past year. So, like you said, I think the world kind of stopped. And as an American, you kind of, you feel ashamed of what happened.
I'm also curious how you process this from afar, because you are in Turkey right now. That's where you're playing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny. The first, as soon as I walked into the gym, everyone was like, oh my gosh, like, how are you doing? Like, what is going on? So it was interesting to get that kind of reaction from coaches and a couple of teammates, because like, we were on display for the world to see. From like a security standpoint, it just shouldn't happen. And then there's also the moral part of this too. We should not see that type of violence over a presidential election.
So I want to understand the locker room dynamic for you in Turkey right now. Are your teammates from all over the world? How many Americans are there? Are you kind of the American who is there to sort of explain, hey, this is what's up back in the foremost democracy in the world?
So I'm actually the only American. We have mostly Turks, and then we have a Russian who is married to a Turk. She and I probably have the most conversations. She speaks the most English too, so we can kind of delve into this a little more. And she was just like, wow, like, I really can't believe this. She's like, what, like, where's the security? And I was like, the security is right there with him. It's complicated, but ultimately I was trying to explain to her kind of why I was supporting Warnock and why I've been talking about racial injustice and all these things that she's seen on my social. It's because of like days like this. And so I think it actually made it a little bit easier for her to understand like why a lot of people feel so passionately about the things that we do.
I can only imagine what it's like for you, who has been through months and months of peaceful protests, strategically, so carefully peaceful protest. Elizabeth, when you see what happened in DC through that lens as a Black athlete who has been criticized for peaceful protest, how does this all fit together to you in your mind?
I think that's another really tough part too, because I think people always want to talk about like the right way to protest, but there is no right way to protest. Like, there's obviously a wrong way, from the noose in front of the Capitol building to seeing a Confederate flag in there. That was unreal. The looting, the facial expressions of the people in there, knowing that they were just so confident, like they were fearless and they were not worried about consequences. And that kind of eerie confidence that they had was really irritating. We, you know, we're people first before we're athletes. And for a lot of us, we're Black people first before anything. And it's important for the audiences that get to view this product to understand that. And I don't think, especially now, I don't think players are going to back down. And I don't think there's going to be any less conversation, any less activism.
What does it make you feel? What does all of this make you think about coming back to the United States of America?
I mean, I still think like, we can't forget we're in a pandemic, so it's not like I'll be out and about by any means. But, you know, I think being with the people that I care about would be important, just to kind of feel a sense of home in that way. And I think everyone's going to have to take some time to kind of self-reflect and self-care and not let this, all of this, overwhelm us, and then and still be reminded that we did make history. And we have to embrace all of that and take that positivity because that hope is going to keep everybody going moving forward.
Elizabeth Williams, forward for the Atlanta Dream on a trying and historic 48 hours for democracy in America, our home. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show was produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Ramona Shelburne, Garrett Lang, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.